Welcome to the Immigrant Stories Program. I'm your host, Walter Gallagher, and my interview today is with Diane Kenny. In 1997, Diane opened the Carbondale Clay Center and invited people of all ages to come make something with their hands. And over the last 20 years, the center has attracted children, students, teachers, and artists throughout the valley and across the United States by offering high-quality ceramic arts programs. I sat down with Diane in her kitchen on a rainy afternoon in May. Diane Kenny, thanks for sitting down with me. And I would like to thank you for all that you've done for the Roaring Fork Valley and Carbondale in particular. You're a great gift to the community, and I appreciate what you've done. I'd like to start by where I usually always start. I want you to talk about your peeps, your people. Where did they come from? Ancestors?
Gosh, my ancestors are from Luxembourg and Germany on my mother's side and straight 100% Irish on my father's side. That's where I got my name and my craziness, probably.
From your father? Was he a wee bit crazy?
Well, yeah, not crazy. He was Irish. He couldn't help it. You know, that saying, oh gosh, I'm troubled, I'm dissatisfied, I'm Irish. But he was a sign painter. My mom was the bookkeeper, and they raised 9 kids. You know, that'd be like me as a potter trying to support 9 children. And
so where were you in that order?
Number 8. Uh-huh. It's a big Irish Catholic family, St. Mary's Parish. You know, it's just when you're growing up, everything is normal and you think everyone lives this way. And then you realize, oh, gee, they don't. You know, we had St. Nicholas Parish, which was the German parish. St. Mary's was the Irish, and St. Athanasius was more Greek, not Greek Orthodox, but Catholics. And anyway, that was our world, and where, you know, school was a couple blocks away, and, you know, I had nuns all through grade school and high school. My grandfather and great-grandfather, Wieland, which means green land, I learned, it's a German name, they were florists. They had flower shops, several in the Chicago area, and they had greenhouses there behind their house, and there were 13 children in my mother's family. I don't think I appreciate it. I was just always thinking about myself as a kid, right? And that's what
right,
you do.
Right, that's what you do.
And my dad out in the shop, painting signs, and he was really, really good at it. I have one in my studio that's worn and faded, but one of my sisters salvaged it, and it says dry cleaners, but it's gold leaf, and he could paint sitting on a milk box or crate. He could paint vertically on the side of a truck in the backyard, and he did all the fire engines and the police cars and fleets of cabs. In fact, I think Yellow Cab in Chicago, I think they're still using his design. Wow. Which is kind of an Art Deco looking design. Dad wore Sears and Roebuck clothes, and the smell associated with him was turpentine and Dutch cleanser, you know.
And
we used to think, who's going to take over the shop? And truthfully, we were little snots. We thought that it was more prestigious if your father wore a suit and tie and worked downtown Chicago. You know, had a briefcase and a trench coat and went, got the L or the Northwestern to work in the city. And I wasn't until many, many years later that I realized what my dad did was, you know, out in the shop by himself, which when I have been in my own studio over the years, I thought, oh, this is what Dad's experience was like. You know, listening to the radio, he loved Laurel and Hardy and Abbott and Costello and some of those Amos and Andy and those radio shows, you know. And basically, he worked alone.
Your father was an artisan.
Yeah, and, you know, he used brushes, and I would see them, and I remember he had a drawing of a cowboy on horseback that was a stencil that he had made, and I just couldn't believe he drew that. But we never considered him an artist, and he had relatives. He had cousins and who were also sign painters, so it was something that ran in their family. And I didn't realize, you know, being going to art school wasn't necessarily considered something you did as a good Catholic girl. You know, what would you do with that? And, you know, and so I was going to be a teacher or, you know, something. But anyway, I wanted something different.
If you're just tuning in, you're listening to the Immigrant Stories program. I'm your host, Walter Gallagher, and my interview today is with Diane Kenny. Diane is the founder and former director of the Carbondale Clay Center. You grew up with eight other siblings, right? Mm-hmm. How many brothers and how many sisters?
There are six girls and three boys. And So two girls and a boy three times. So basically I had a different upbringing than the older kids did. You know, by the time I was born, my oldest sister was 15, and really, I heard, not happy that her mother was still having babies. It was, you know, embarrassing to her. She's a sophomore in high school, and, you know, plus the older kids needed to take care of the younger, the right. little kids, and they weren't thrilled about that either. But
did your mom work outside the house, or was she?
She did. She worked outside the house. It's hard to believe, but for more than 50 years on and off, but she loved to go to work, and she worked for her father when she was a young girl, like 15. She went to business college for half a year, and she was really good with accounting and numbers, and she did all of that. And then she worked, the uncles, her brothers, got set up in the flower business, but she didn't because she was the girl, even though my grandfather, I heard, used to call her, or the family called her Pa's girl, because when he couldn't get the numbers to work out, he would call Marie, my mom, and she would figure it out. But mother was in charge of pretty much everything in the house, and she did... She managed, we still have some accounting books where she kept track of pennies. And, you know, on Sunday mornings, we'd go to Mass at 9 o'clock, all the kids, was the kids' Mass at the parish. And we each had an envelope lined up on the desk with our, you know, when the collection came around. And Mother planned that sometimes there was only a penny in there, or 2 cents, or 3 cents, or a nickel was a good Sunday, because she had, you know, seven or eight of those envelopes at any one time.
Growing up Catholic, there's always this expectation, or at least this desire to have a child either enter the priesthood or become a nun.
In those days, it was considered an honor to have a child, but who would enter the priesthood or the convent? But Mother wasn't like that. She pretty much left us on our own. My sister Kathleen entered the convent first, and she's 2 years older. And she had stumbled on this order. It was a Mercedarian Missionaries of Beres, and the history goes back to the 13th century, and it's involved with the Moors invading Spain. I mean, it's very fascinating history. I knew that I wanted something different, and I didn't want to enter this order because I didn't want to do the same thing my sister did.
So what was it about this order that attracted you? I mean, at this time in your life, when a lot of other kids are going in a totally different direction, where were you that this appealed to you? What was going on in your life?
I didn't exactly want to do it, but I felt like, you know, when you're a senior in high school at an all-girls school, there's always a senior retreat, and the priest comes, and then you have this day where everyone's in the chapel waiting to go talk to the priest and bent over on our knees praying, and I'm hoping I don't get picked, not by the priest, but by God, because it's like, I don't want to be a nun. And but I just wanted I remember writing out my application. I just want to do what God wants me to. You know, I mean, I was so naive. But I also knew I didn't want my story to be, what happened to Diane? Well, let's see. She married a lawyer. I think they're in Ohio, and I think she has two kids. And, you know, I'm not sure. You know, but that was the story for women. Or you could be a secretary, a nurse, or a teacher. But those weren't valued. It's like, and if you were... on your own, you were pitied, you know, oh my God, she never got married. That's so too bad. And now she's so old.
Well, it was still sort of the end of that era where a woman was referred to as a spinster if she wasn't married.
Yeah, exactly. And so there was that. And this sounds really strange, but it seemed more exciting. It meant I could end up in Latin America or Africa or Micronesia, and certainly would go to Spain at some point. But it was a super strict order, because even though they had become missionaries and had a mission work outside the convent, they still had 90% of the internal practices of the cloister, which was very strict. And things like, if the convent is next door to your parents' house and your father dies, you can't go home for them. Wow. You can't leave, and you can't make home visits, and you couldn't talk on the phone except maybe once a year on your birthday or something.
So how was your first year?
Well,
given that,
you know, I was just stunned by everything. But
so what was the adjustment like? I mean, homesick.
It was very strange. We were American girls, North American. We were a very big minority. In other words, I learned what it was like to be a minority, because this was a training house. At this point, the nuns had been in Kansas City about 15 years or so, 12, 15, since the very late 40s. So this was 1962, so a long time, and almost 20 years. And wow.
It's serious.
Yeah, it's
the background music.
I know. It's amazing. The adjustment was, it was so new and so different and so stunning that, you know, I just went along. But in retrospect, or even then, I realized that it was also very stressful, because we didn't have any free time. We got up at 4:25 in the morning and went to bed at 9 at night. The lights were out. But every minute of the day was scheduled, and there was 25 minutes in the day at a point after lunch where you could close your door and lie in your bed or darn your stockings or, you know, write a letter home or something. But, you know, it was very regimented. And since that time, I have a hard time with fixed schedules, I have to say. But it was stressful. But also with the other postulants who came from different places, everything seemed funny a lot. I mean, you know how it is when you aren't supposed to laugh, and you can't help but laugh. So the customs that they were teaching us, like how to eat an apple with a fork and a knife.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to the Immigrant Stories program. I'm your host, Walter Gallagher, and my interview today is with Diane Kenny. Diane entered the convent and began her cloistered life in 1962. A time of great change for the Catholic Church and the world. And over the next 8 years, though, Diane was allowed to move from a cloistered life to working in the community and attending college. It was at college that her worldview changed profoundly.
I graduated in 71 from college, and by then, I was born with a radical spirit. It wasn't just influenced by the time, but, you know, the Black Panthers had a table set up at Donnelly one time. I remember stopping to talk to them, you know, and they were talking about things that I couldn't believe, you know, like there's going to be guns in the streets. And then, of course, I was profoundly affected by the Vietnam War. I hated that I wanted to be out there protesting that. And then the assassinations of the two Kennedy brothers in the 60s, and then Martin Luther King broke my heart.
Yeah, broke a lot of hearts, mine as well.
Yeah.
Being young and during that time was crushing.
Yes, it was just, I wanted to be part of the revolution. And I didn't know what that meant, but when I graduated, it was so interesting. You know, these days I have trouble deciding what to wear or what to eat, order in a restaurant. But I woke up one day and realized I don't belong here anymore. And it was within 2 weeks, I was out.
When Diane left the convent, she began exploring her radical spirit. She actively protested the Vietnam War and explored liberation theology. She waitressed some and taught in the inner city and joined the Venceremos Brigade and went to Cuba for 4 months. But eventually she returned to Kansas City and joined a gospel-based community working for social justice.
I just realized I'm not a revolutionary in the sense of armed struggle. I don't have what it takes, and I don't believe in that either.
So how did you channel that? You changed?
Well, it was also the era of, granola and macrame and pottery as, hanging planters with clay pots, and we were living communally, and I obviously had an artistic talent, and which in the convent even, I'm doing the banners and the bulletin boards, things like that, making signs, and I'm pretty good at lettering. And
your father's daughter.
Yeah, and I can just use magic markers and make pretty good signs and all that. And so someone gave us a wheel, a potter's wheel, and the first time I saw somebody throw a pot on a potter's wheel, I nearly fainted. I thought that was the most amazing thing I've ever seen, and beautiful to take this lump of clay and turn it into a bottle. I just couldn't believe it. And so as this community, one of our values was to support the arts, and, we were... we were against and for all the right things. We were against sexism, ageism, and for feminism and for art and so forth. So this fit in the value system, and I started taking a night class at somebody's studio, and I would bring one of the little kids with me, and then I started taking night classes at the Art Institute in Kansas City, and then realized that I really wanted to do this thing and get good at it, and it was extremely hard because I got turned down the first time I applied to be a full-time student at the Art Institute. I already had a college degree, and this would be another undergraduate program, but it was, without me knowing it, it just happened to be like the best program in the country at that time.
So the first time they turned you down, but you came back again.
I came back, I practiced on my own, and I got accepted. So I was, and then I went full-time 5 days a week for almost 3 years. And it was a great experience. So it was gave me such a good foundation.
So you hung your shingle out and started making pots and letting people know that's what you were and what you were doing.
Yeah, and having a Christmas sale and so forth. And what happened too was this, everything kind of overlapped, right? And I mean, as it does in people's lives. And I had spent a summer of 1972. I'd met this minister on the bus going to this demonstration in D.C. He was starting a place called Shadow Cliff in Grand Lake, Colorado, and he was using work camps. He was a minister at the K-State in Manhattan, and he had students pretty much coming out for various weeks or the whole summer to do work and building this retreat center, and it's called Shadow Cliff. I spent that summer working at this place in Grand Lake, so I fell in love with Colorado. And it just so happened that this community I connected with in Kansas City and became part of in January of 73, they owned property on the road where I live right now. They own a cabin at the end of this road, and they still do own it. The five daughters own it together now. Anyway, so they still own that cabin, and that's how I used to come out here to Colorado, and that's how I ended up in this valley.
When did you decide that this is it's not just a place I'm going to visit, but I'm going to live here?
Well, so I used to come out in the summers stay at the cabin. Kansas City is really hot and humid, so I'd come out for a few weeks in August, and I got to know some people. And when the woman who was teaching at CRMS, teaching ceramics, she quit her job that summer. And John Stickney called me and said, I should apply for it. And by then, it's 1980. It was 84. I was just married in 83 to John McCormick, my husband. He also loved Colorado and wanted to move to Colorado if we could figure out a way to do it. And we were coming anyway to visit, to be at the cabin. And I was interviewed the morning after Mountain Fair, and they hired me, and we had 2 weeks to go back and, you know, and pack up and move part of my studio, et cetera. So the first year I was full time, I taught two sections of Spanish and then ceramics too. And that was, you know, our toehold here. And plus, we met wonderful people at the teachers, fellow teachers at CRMS.
Tell me about the birth of the Clay Center.
It's something I'd been stewing on and thinking about. I had my own studio. I'd left CRMS in 88. I'd taught there 4 years, but only 1 year full time, because I wanted to be a studio potter too. And I had seen and knew about places around the country, in Baltimore and Philadelphia and Minneapolis, where they had clay centers. And I just thought it was a good fit for Carbondale. And people also asked me about teaching, if I ever taught classes, and I did teach some at my studio. But I realized, you know, there needs to be a place where people can come and go. So I just was thinking about it for years and nosing around in town, who owns what and how could we make this happen, and started to organize other potters I knew or and wasn't quite sure, but I had a model. I had ideas of how to do this, partly because of training in community organizing as a nun, and then in that community, and then within Macomb, I did organize a community, a free university that was in addition to college classes, but it was about, and I did this in the neighborhood in Kansas City too, in the Northeast.
So you had your toolkit.
Yeah, yeah. And we started looking around, and I was blessed to have the ideas and basically the skills to do this, like writing proposals and things like that. And my path crossed with a benefactor who had also been thinking about it would be good to have a clay program down valley. That was Mike Stranahan. And Dan Troutman was also instrumental in introducing us and also helping in that first year. And we were going to be in the old Mid-Continent building, one of those buildings over there, those huge cement buildings.
Oh, yeah.
And they were owned by four local businessmen. And we started negotiating and realizing, oh my gosh, we're going to have to punch out concrete walls to get light. And there, anyway, it started to become more and more, or less and less appealing, I should say, and more expensive and not owning it. And then I remember Mike said to me, well, are you going to give up? And I said, no, are you? He said, I'm not if you're not. And I said, then I'm not. And I remember riding my bike to town on a summer day and hanging out by the on the corner where the Nugget is during the day and just asking, do you know who owns that over there and that building there? And someone, and I forget who, and they reminded me recently that they told me, but It was a building where the Clay Center is, and that's how it came about. And we had the blessing of funding to purchase the building and then retrofit it. And for ceramics is not something that you can easily say do at Third Street, because, you know, and as a studio, I mean, people do that, but it's hard because of the dust and the kills, and, you know, it's messy and so forth. So we had to, like, cut a drain to a dry well so that we didn't screw up any plumbing system and et cetera, et cetera. And Dan Troutman was really wonderful in a lot of the helping to, you know, put in new doors and windows and unpacked the wheels when they came, and, you know, things like that. And
well, Carbondale is a great place to launch a new idea, isn't it?
Yes, it was a good fit. And You know, I just wanted it to be about excellence in the ceramic arts, and I wanted it to be also a place where connecting to the national ceramics community. And they do have a residency program, which I love, which is mostly young people who are with BFAs or MFAs or just a really keen interest, but they come for a year or two. And so it connects the Clay Center to the bigger world, too, in ceramics. So it's not just a Main Street, although it's wonderful, it's an asset on Main Street, and I'm really proud of what they're doing there. Yeah, I was there for 8 years. Yeah, so
yeah, mm-hmm. You must feel real good about that.
I do. I know it's never for any nonprofit. It's not easy, and
right. You
know, the fundraising is the least fun part of the nonprofit, although they make it fun. But I'm just really, I walk in there or go to First Fridays there, and I'm so proud of what, it's mostly young people, and I used to know everyone who was there, like for an event. Like when we opened in December of 1997, we counted 200 people who came, and I knew them all more or less, but I don't know, I see it's, wow, I don't know who all these people are,
yeah.
And they're mostly young, and that makes me really happy, you know.
Yeah.
This tradition of community art and participatory public art, it's still
yeah.
happening.
The sign painter's daughter.
Yeah.
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 Thanks, Diane.
Okay, thank you, Walter, so much.
That was Diane Kenny. For more on immigrant stories, please go to our website, immigrantstories.net. Thanks for listening.